This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, this is Frida Liu. You're listening to Enterprise. I last spoke to Dr. Anjula Maya Singh Bias, I just call her Dr. Anjula, in 2019 when she was awarded the Young Global Leader in 2019 by the World Economic Forum. Well, lots of things have happened since. She was recently named as one of the world's 50 most influential people navigating disruption by Agile 50. She's also recently been appointed chair of the International Board for Amnesty International, in addition to being the founder and consultant psychologist at Fourth Dimension Consultancy. Good morning, Dr. Anjula.
Good morning, Frida. It's nice to be speaking with you again.
So many things have happened in life, in your life since. And of course, you know, when we spoke, it was before the pandemic. And you said mental health was on the rise in that interview. Tell me how you've been and what you see happening the last 2 years in your work as a psychologist. Because when you said that mental health was on the rise, that was pre-pandemic. What has happened now?
Well, if it was on the rise, it is now, mental health is now its own epidemic. And right. If there's a silver lining that has come from all of this, it's the following. Before, psychology may not have necessarily had a seat at the table of hard sciences, but now it does. Workplaces, institutions, governments realize how important mental health is because of the pandemic, whether it's, you know, the mental skepticism about vaccines, how to convince populations to do things, how to ensure there's not panic and everybody's buying toilet paper and you're running out of stock. And then also what it means mentally to be in quarantine or lockdown. So mental health, of course, has been severely, severely affected. But at the same time, people realize its worth and its importance.
Now, okay, you have recently been appointed chair of the International Board for Amnesty International, and I want to talk about that later in greater detail. So I was just going through your bio, and this is something, you know, I didn't ask enough about, but you are the only international psychology trauma in Malaysia, right? Now, what exactly is this?
Yes, good question. So generally, when people think of psychology, they think of clinical psychology, which has a longer history. Clinical psychology has its antecedents in the global north. It's sort of European, Viennese-based when you think of Freud, Jung. Now, the thing about clinical psychology is that it might not be applicable to all cultural contexts. Right. So, you know, it's not a one size fits all. A lot of times you'll have students who go abroad and study psychology. They come back and then they try to apply what they learn that's based in a particular historical, social, cultural reality that doesn't fit in Malaysia, for example. So international psychology's premise underlying it is it's a very nascent, cutting edge field of psychology. And its premise is that every nation state has its own indigenous wisdom. And when you apply that, you will have better outcomes. So for example, when I was doing my doctorate dissertation, the rule was that you have to do a dissertation about any country except for the United States of America. And why that is so important is that when you look at the peer-reviewed scientific journal studies, the majority of the studies, what is considered prestigious studies, are coming out of the United States. And the subject matters for those experiments and the research are white, Caucasian, undergraduate males. How is that relatable to us? It's not. So it's about, you know, for example, I've presented papers on Islamic psychology and what that unique strand brings to the table. And for example, when there was that very tragic New Zealand mosque bombing, there's something about, like, you know, embedded in the in Islam that actually helps on average people cope better in that resiliency. And it's important to bring that out. The scriptures, the religious texts really talk about acceptance and sort of letting go. And when you highlight that, that can be a very important healing factor. And that might not necessarily be captured by clinical psychology.
Right. And it's so interesting, right? You're right, right? How we look at psychology has always been the Western perspective and what we've been, you know, we've read about and taught about. Now, you also helped shape the Chicago School's first human rights course while doing your PhD in international psychology. How do you connect human rights to psychology?
Yeah, so that conversation has gathered more speed in the past decade. When you look at the, you know, UN Declaration of Human Rights and its various conventions, it does talk about the right to physical health, the right to mental health, the right to practice freedom of religion, conscious thought, expression, you know, the freedom to congregate together, to meet with people, to practice basically freedoms. And when those are curtailed, it naturally will have a mental health effects.
Hmm.
So, you know, the psychologists, we take an oath, we have an ethics code that we follow, and it is about ensuring our life's work, the well-being of societies and individuals. Hmm. And if you do not have rights, that's going to really have an impact on your mental health and well-being. So for example, just coming back to your question about also, you know, differences between international psychology and clinical, a lot of times in therapy, I employ feminist theory and feminist thoughts. I'm not scared to get political.
Mm.
If your country is going through upheavals, there's a lot of change in power, there's not stability, of course that's going to affect your mental health. And a lot of times clinical psychology is like, you know, it's just the individual. It is not the individual. If I'm talking to an African and, you know, there's a lot of racism, a lot of discrimination, and if somebody has a relative that has a knee to their neck,
mm.
as a therapist and a psychologist, it is not fair to say, you know, just change your thoughts, it'll be okay. No, society needs to change. The government needs to change. People need to learn. So it's institutional, systemic.
Right. No, I mean, you're right. You know, what's happened in Malaysia in the last couple of years, right, does have an impact on me and how, you know, and how I feel and my freedom, you know, so to speak, right? And not physical freedom, but even just the mental freedom, right? You know, when you were awarded the Young Global Leader in 2019, you were about, that when we, our last conversation, you were about to head to Greenland. Tell me, what was that experience like?
That was a life-changing experience. You know, so the World Economic Forum selected about 20 people, and it was a motley crew of people. For example, there was the managing director of the Economist Group from China. There was ex-Arsenal footballer Matthew Flamini, but all people that can and have an interest in climate. So we joined leading climate scientists in Greenland, and there's experiential knowledge. I mean, there's theoretical abstract knowledge, and then there's experiential, where you get to experience it. And my colleagues and I were watching icebergs, and in front of our eyes, an iceberg that was the size of a skyscraper cracked in half.
Wow.
In front of us. And that's a very rare scientific event, which is called calving. And as this iceberg started to calve, the waves reached tsunami level, and everybody started to run to sort of save their lives and be safe. But we caught it on video, and Al Gore, former Vice President Al Gore of the United States, has used that footage to teach about climate change. And when I came back to Malaysia, you know, often there's this idea that human rights, climate change, feminism, all Western imports, has nothing to do with our culture. But the thing is, you know, it's about messaging. So I simply said that in 10 years, the climate will become so hot that people cannot make their pilgrimage to Mecca. And then everybody started listening. Okay, this is really real, which it is. All of us need to get behind it.
Right. It's so interesting because on your LinkedIn profile, you know, you says the topics you're keen on are policy, psychology, planet, and people. And you know, I think that story probably encapsulates all of it.
Yes, it very much does. And they're all very interrelated. People should have a hand in shaping policy. Policy should be responsive to people's needs. And, you know, when we talk about a country's problem or subjective problems, it actually doesn't matter if we don't have a planet. And I see a lot of young people in therapy, you know, parents think they're going through a phase, they're being difficult, they don't want to study. But a lot of times their apathy, they don't want to study because they're like, what's the point? You haven't left a planet for us. They are justifiably angry.
Right, Right. All right. We'll talk a little bit about your recent appointment as chair of the International Board for Amnesty International in just a moment. I'm here with Dr. Anjula Mayasingh Bias. Stay tuned to Enterprise, BFM 89.9.
Baba from Malacca. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, this is Priya Liu. If you've just joined us, I'm speaking to Dr. Anjula Mayasingh Bias. We last spoke in 2019. Many things have happened for her since, too many. She's one of the world's 50 most influential people navigating a disruption according to Agile 50. She's been appointed chair of the International Board for Amnesty International. And of course, she's a founder and consultant psychologist at Fourth Dimension Consultancy. Now, before we get into your recent appointment, right, you call yourself a semi retired model. Are you still open to doing more work in this area?
Yeah, Frida, nothing escapes you, Frida. You do your due diligence. I love it. I am, but it's a very different paradigm than when I was doing it full time. I mean, when I was sort of discovered in modeling, truth be told, I was just, you know, like many students, I was flat broke and it was entertaining and that's that. And it was fun. Yeah. I do realize the power of media, and it's very important to use your celebrity wisely. So I'm very selective in what I choose. So for example, if a, you know, jewelry brand comes to me and asks for an endorsement or a model, instead of looking at, you know, how much they'll pay or how pretty the jewelry is, it's, you know, I'll ask, is it conflict diamonds? How are they sourced? Is it a sustainable supply chain? So on and so forth. For example, a very worldwide very famous lingerie company asked for me to front their recent campaign, the rebranding in terms of rights and equity and gender respect. But what was so interesting is that they're not walking the talk. It's what you call window dressing. So they are, you know, the women empowerment, but they're not ready to pay the women. I'm like, right. How for this campaign? And I'm like, okay, how does that work? They're like, we will give you free lingerie. That's not equity. Women have been doing unpaid labor. You know, when people are like, oh, women should work, get very clear. Women have always worked. They just haven't been paid for it. So obviously I said no.
Right. So it's greenwashing to a certain extent, and that's such an important message as well, right? I mean, and when you do promote certain brands, it speaks volumes, right? I mean, that's what you can use your celebrity for.
Absolutely. It needs to have been vetted properly and my stamp of approval. And you know what? People might, and I'm sure you're used to this as a woman, they might characterize me as difficult, but if difficult means being switched on, then call me difficult.
Right. Okay, let's talk about your recent appointment as chair of the International Board with Amnesty International. Congratulations, right? And of course, you've been, you know, tied up or working with them for over, you know, over close to 5 years, right? So what does this role mean to you?
Well, I mean, I've had such a love story with Amnesty. And of course, like we were just speaking about, I wouldn't be associated with or working for or with any brand or organization that didn't resonate with my values deeply. So Amnesty International is the world's largest human rights organization. It's a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And if I were to sum up its ethos, it's to fight for a world where rights are enjoyed by all people. And my very first amnesty action I ever took was signing a petition for our beloved cartoonist from Malaysia, Zunar, whose freedom of movement and expression was being especially curtailed. So this was a campaign that Amnesty International Malaysia, so Amnesty has offices everywhere in the world, was doing. And then I, you know, so I was a volunteer, and then I ran for election and was on the board of Amnesty Malaysia. I chaired it for 2 years. I ran for elections again, made it onto the international board. It's a very multicultural board with people from, of course, all around the world. And then I had the deep privilege and honor of being voted by the international board to chair the board. So that basically means I, along with my teammates, 10 other board members, we are the stewards of the mission and the value of the whole organization globally.
Right. Okay. And I just want to know, like, what's top of mind for Amnesty International right now? And I guess, what do you hope to change or revolutionize?
That's a great question. I mean, there's obviously unfortunately, there's no shortage of human rights issues. We look at what's happening in Hong Kong, obviously, even here in Malaysia, every country, it's not singling one out. Mm. So because the nature of violations and the speed at which they're happening and the volume, we want to continue to future-proof our organization. We want to continue to innovate, to be agile, to be light on our feet, and to really put forth a wellness, feminist leadership and anti-racist agenda. So these are some of the things that we're focusing on. I mean, organizations can be very complex, and in order to be an authority on the outside, to continue to be, we must always look at ourselves first and what we're doing also on the inside. And there's always room for improvement. So these are some of the preoccupations of the International Board.
Right. Okay. And, you know, what would be your you know, priorities personally? I'm just looking at so many things that you're, you know, doing at the moment. What's top of mind for you at the moment? Because there's also your work in the consultancy, and there's this and all that. How do you fit this all together?
Very, very carefully. Right now I have 18-hour days. But again, I feel in terms of Amnesty work, I feel very supported by my board. You know, I work a lot with London time. So that means my mornings and afternoons are, of course, free to speak with therapy clients. They are always my priority. And then London opens at around 4 or 5 p.m. our time in Malaysia. So then I start working on human rights issues. Right, right now, as we speak, I have to sit an exam. I hope I pass. It's a master's level degree in governance. So we'll see what happens. So right now, I still also have my student hat on. Right. But, you know, this is the time to do it. You got to ask yourself if you feel alive doing your work, and this is my life's work. So I might be physically tired, but I'm not mentally tired. The work excites me. There's the difference.
Right. Well, you know, it's always been interesting to talk to you. Every day is a highlight with you. It's been such a pleasure. And congratulations again, being appointed chair of the International Board for Amnesty International. I've been speaking to Dr. Anjula Maya Singh Byers. You've been listening to Enterprise BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.